From WWNO, this is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. This and every week, we talk to people in Louisiana who've devoted their lives to music. We want to hear about their experiences and listen to what they're listening to, because that's where our music comes from. This week, bandleader David Torkanowski describes growing up in New Orleans on Britannia Street, where there were violins and castanets.
In my own upbringing, I had a confluence of African rhythm and European melody and harmony in my own house. So maybe bringing that to the table is what people thought, oh man, white boy can play.
That's David White Boy Torkanowski coming up on Music Inside Out. But first, the newscast. David Torkanowski says he can hear the difference between a pianist and a piano player, and that he falls into the category of piano player. The difference has something to do with ability and humility. We're going to ask him to explain that in a minute. But if what Mr. Torkanowski says is true, this is what a humble piano player of his caliber sounds like. David Torkanowski has made a career as a musician, bandleader, arranger, and producer of progressive jazz, funk, and soul in New Orleans and around the planet. He was a founding member of the jazz ensemble Astro Project. He's worked with Diane Reeves, The Meters, and the Neville Brothers. He accompanied Irma Thomas on her Grammy-winning album, After the Rain. And he has put together one-of-a-kind collections of New Orleans artists for various projects, including his latest, Fleur de Brie. David Torkanowski was born to be a musician. He's the son of a symphony conductor and a flamenco dancer. Thanks for having us over.
Thank you.
What is the difference between a pianist and a piano player?
Level of proficiency, fluency, precision. You know, now some of the best people that sit behind a piano are piano players. You know, Fess was a piano player.
Professor Longhair.
Yeah, even though his execution was flawless. You know, I tend to think of pianists as more people that can deal with Chopin and Liszt.
I guess by extrapolation, it's rare to find a piano player in classical music.
That's true.
But in jazz, you can have both. You can have a pianist or you can have piano player.
Right. That, of course, that's not absolute, but that's a good rule.
Okay.
It's more so about execution, classical music, and jazz music is more about intent. People can feel what you meant more when you're expressing yourself in improvisation than classical music. I mean, classical music is, we don't care what you meant. Did you execute the composer's wishes here? And, you know, how flawlessly did you do so? Jazz music is about interpretation and intent.
So tell us now, what was it like to grow up in your family, in your house, in New Orleans, I'm assuming? Your father, Werner Torkanowski, was the conductor of the New Orleans Philharmonic.
That's correct.
Symphony, right?
Right.
For 14 years, I want to say, huh?
That's about right, yes.
What did it sound like?
Well, my mother had gypsies around the house from Spain, and my father had classical luminaries around the house, Eugenia Stoneman, Itzhak Perlman, Isaac Stern. So it was a confluence of learned musicians and indigenous artists that were, it was pretty special.
You know, so when you say that all these people were in your house, Itzhak Perlman, Isaac Stern, flamenco dancers, other Spanish performers, what neighborhood did you live in?
You know, uptown New Orleans on Britannia Street. It was an incredible nexus of artistic energy that shaped who I am.
Your father was not born a New Orleanian.
No.
Now, where was he from?
He was born in Germany and raised in Israel. He was an excellent violinist and got a lot of work immediately in the New York pits, and he became concertmaster and then became a conductor from there.
So how did he meet this exotic, I hate to use that word, but it's true. I mean, this exotic flamenco.
Talking about my mother, yeah.
Dancer? I mean, how does that happen?
She was performing in New York with Ciro, who was went on to become the head of the National Folkloric Company of Spain. You know, he was the flamenco impresario. And my father conducted for her in New York and was smitten, apparently.
Well, it's hard not to be smitten by a flamenco dancer, I have to say, passionate, male or female.
Passionate woman exerting herself, absolutely.
And so your mother, is she from Spain?
She was born in New York, but she at 10th grade, she went to study in Spain and dance with Carmen Amaya.
Wanted a collection of first albums. That shows my age. First album, I guess first CDs now. Mm-hmm. But first albums in that, first albums of artists take the longest to make. You understand what I'm saying?
Right,
if you make an album or a CD at 26 years old, then it's taking you 26 years to make that, as opposed to...
I see your point. That's
your
excellent.
Second
That's
album.
Right. That's right.
Now, do you ever listen to your first CD, your first album, Steppin' Out?
I do. Yeah, I do. I like it much better now than I did then, you know. But, yeah, I like it.
What kind of artistic license did you have?
Complete. They said, who do you want? I said, I just played a few gigs with Donald Byrd. I'd like him to be on my record. So he was. There was a brilliant tenor player who now lives in Paris named Rick Margitza. He's on the record. Herlin Riley's on the record. I mean, that was still back in the day when there was a record industry, and Rounder Records was heavily invested in the culture of New Orleans with the Mardi Gras Indians, with Johnny Adams, releasing Professor Longhair records. James Booker was on Rounder. So I was included as part of the New Orleans Jazz Masters series. They knew they weren't going to make a bunch of money from an unknown piano player playing his original music that pushed the boundaries of what people thought New Orleans music is. So I was doing a lot of studio work for Rounder, and they said, hey, your turn.
When I listened to that album, you know, or CD, whichever you like
that
to call
Edison,
it.
That Edison Cylinder.
Indeed. It is extremely lush. We played a little of Spring Can Really Hang You Up the Most earlier in our introduction, but there's another cut on this record that I love, which is called Patrocinio.
Right.
What does
it
mean?
It rolls off the palate. It is my grandmother's first name, my mother's mother. Both of my parents were out doing art, and my grandmother was around more than most grandmothers were. And, you know, she was just an incredible spirit. She emigrated from Spain through Cuba to New York and worked in the garment district. And she sang arias on the radio when radio was live.
Wow.
But she was also raised in very Victorian, where to be a performer was frowned upon as in terms of social station. So when live broadcast got audiences, she stopped singing.
No.
Yeah. So she was an amazing spirit. So she goes, you know, baby, God gave me a gift, and when I didn't use it, I lost it. Patrocinio de Romero de Viera. So this tune is called Patrocinio. Check it.
This is something that you composed.
Oh, sure, with her in mind.
And so what, did she live to hear it?
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Really, what did she think of this
selection?
She thought
it was beautiful. Yeah. You know, and, you know, I mean, she was an amazing person. She was one of those people that goes, you know, baby, I don't have to go to church. I say, why is that, Grandma? She goes, because I can pray in the kitchen, but I can't cook in church. Cool, huh?
Yeah, the wafer doesn't go so well with, like, you know, Tony Sasheries.
There you go. There you go. That's funny.
But the thing about your original compositions that makes them exciting to listen to is that there's a certain romance to them, and there's a lushness not only in the notes that you hear, but also in the silences.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean, space is very important, and especially growing up in New Orleans, and Danny Barker used to describe it as, you know, we're underwater, we're below sea level, we're surrounded by water, with lakes to the north and bayous to the south and a river. The music, as it decays in this humidity, that space is as much a part of the music as any note you may play.
But then also, you have associated that kind of romance that people hear in your music to something coming from Spanish culture.
It is. It's called duende, which is an inner spirit of, you know, the flamenco singing and the Spanish music has much angst and romance in it. It has a lot of passion. And I think that my German father and my Spanish mother, that's where I get that strong sense of romance and passion.
But you also have a restlessness in you, artistically.
That's called ADD.
Well, I was, you know, trying to be kind.
Yeah.
But yes, you do beautiful ballads. But you also have been drawn to free-form jazz. Talk to us about that. Where does that drive come from, and where does that energy come from?
To me, it's all the same music. It's all about prayer. You know, now Tony DeGrotte, who was pretty much the founding force behind the Astral Project, he introduced me to Indian ragas and chants, which became part of the prayer of music. Now, you know, avant-garde music, I mean, I used to play a lot with James Black, and I've played with Joe Henderson, and so all of these masters have, you know, taught me that, look, you can't just think about music one way, or you're going to be trapped in that thinking. So to me, you know, I play postmodern New Orleans music, but I play New Orleans music. So, and it's traditional in the sense that traditional is not a style, it's an attitude.
We're talking to the postmodern and traditional David Torkanowski. He'll be back with us after the break. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out. We're talking with David Torkanowski, one of the founding members of the progressive jazz group Astral Project. We're playing their composition called Foxy Roxy. Why? Because it's great! We'll be right back. was Foxy Roxy by Astral Project, back in the day when David Torkanowski was on piano. David Torkanowski grew up in New Orleans. We asked him about studying in Boston at the Berklee School of Music.
Of course, you can imagine the culture of dark, dank Back Bay Boston was so different than what I'd experienced here. Just surviving was a whole different animal. I mean, you can be homeless in New Orleans. You can go by so-and-so mom and them. Always got something on a stove.
That's
in
right.
In Boston, if you ain't making money, you ain't eating.
Yeah, you can't be chubby and homeless in Boston.
Ah, that's pretty funny.
You can be chubby and homeless in New Orleans really easily. So when you got back from Berklee, you know, you came back to New Orleans and just decided that you were still going to school?
Well, the reason I left school was I got a call. Halfway through my second year, I got a call from Scotty Hill, say, hey, we got a gig at Cape Cod, man, come make the gig with us. So, of course, I said, sure. And after playing, you know, more intellectual and academic music for 2 years, I thought, oh, man, they bring the humidity with them when they're playing. I want some of that. So I came back home and started studying with the masters.
And the masters were?
Ellis, Marcellus, James Black, John Brunius, Red Morgan, Earl Turbinton. Then I joined the Astral Project, and there was a time where we had a 4-night-a-week gig at the Absinthe Bar, and our singer was Bobby McFerrin. We're the ones who encouraged Bobby to sing a cappella. You got one by yourself, bro.
Wow.
Yeah. And then after our 4-hour gig was over, we play another 5 hours right after that as the rhythm section for Luther Kent's horn-driven blues band.
Oh, my goodness.
So I learned a lot about what to do and a lot about what not to do on that gig. You know, that was my university.
Wow.
New Orleans has more icons of this music per capita than any place on earth. And the ancestry still is evident in notes that are played here. You hear Trombone Shorty play, even though he may be doing a Lenny Kravitz type rock tune, when he plays his horn, you can still hear Kid Thomas Valentine in his playing. He pays homage to the ancestors.
I got a whole lot of to do, and I'm so glad to see you.
You know, there's a new school of young brass band players who shall remain nameless, Shamar Allen, that somehow revel in eschewing the tradition. Like, he's got this video called Mr. Old Man, which features kind of a mustached, Jewish-haired, paunch belly guy that looks way too much like me for me to like it.
Mr. Old Man, why you keep complaining? And not much from your day still remaining. You're like a walking time machine looking crazy. And look around you, everything is changing except you. You're stuck in your ways. You talk about the past like it's today. And I don't know what to say about you except you really need to put up your 45 and get an MP3.
But it's basically saying, I don't need that old stuff. I'm doing some new stuff. And, you know, to me, that's not what being in New Orleans and being a New Orleans musician is about. It's about celebrating the ancestry.
Exactly. But I want to talk a little bit about accompanying performers.
Accompanying is an art form. If you're talking about accompanying a singer, that's a very intimate relationship. A singer and a pianist have to be synergistic.
There's something about your willingness to listen, you know what I mean, in the work that you do with Diane Reeves or the work you've done with Irma Thomas or others. You seem to know how to listen as opposed to anticipate.
That's exactly what it is. And Johnny Badakovich, a great New Orleans drummer, says you take 40% of the space and give 60% of your attention. So it's sort of like when you have a conversation with someone. When you're listening to what they're saying, is your brain already formulating what you're going to say in response? Or are you truly, truly listening? And is it a true exchange of information and energy and love? On the bandstand, it's the same thing. You don't want to anticipate because then you cut off the possibility of surprise and a special moment.
talk to me a little bit about Irma Thomas.
Irma Thomas is just one of the, as NPR celebrated, one of the 50 greatest voices of mankind. And that's not overstating it. What an incredibly powerful voice and just a moral, resolute human being. Love her.
Love her too.
Lights are down and the stage is bare, and no more magic's in the air. There's not a friend in sight to care. Your tears no one will share. Bad and your bed is worst, and there's no who to turn to first. When you've done everything you can, no one's there to take your hand. Your trust in me, my love will see you through. When the final candles flickered out, why me is all you can think about. When all your joy has disappeared, your future is
still gives me chills, I have to say. Every time I listen to it, it gives me chills.
That was an added selection after the fact. I don't know if it was, oh, we need another tune for the record, but this was done right in this very room that we're sitting in, just my piano and her. I was nervous as hell. Because, I mean, every note you do with an icon of history is by definition history.
And this has nothing to do with the storm, even. You know what I mean? Even though Katrina, after the fact, you can't help but listen to the album and think about Katrina. The album wasn't made with Katrina in mind.
That's correct. It wasn't.
Right. And so, apart from Katrina, when you listen to that song, you feel as if somebody's speaking to you. I don't know if it's the creator or what, but someone is speaking to you.
It was made in the place that Katrina happened. So all of the souls that were lost in that storm and all of the souls that will forever be affected by that storm is part of the patina of that record and that song in particular.
Exactly. I read the Keith Spira book, Groove Interrupted. He has a chapter on Jeremy Davenport and the work that you did with Jeremy Davenport right. on one of his latest albums.
Correct.
You two, Jeremy Davenport and yourself, you are characterized or self-characterized as self-loathers.
Meaning we're hypercritical. And I would say I'm in the minor leagues in that category and he is in the Smithsonian in that category.
When I take my sugar to tea, all the boys are jealous of me. 'Cause I never take her where the gang goes when I take my sugar to tea.
Keith Spira really succeeded in capturing just how advanced Jeremy's anal retention is.
Yeah, but he put you in the same pod, my friend.
Yes,
I mean,
my lawyers are looking into that.
Are you ever satisfied with the first take?
Back when I first started recording, no, because I came up in the Alan Toussaint School of Production, and it was, okay, right, take 62, and by the time you get to take 62, everything that you might have done to surprise or change your approach, that's already been done in the middle 30s. He was striving for human performance, but perfection in human performance. So, you know, there was a method to that. So I used to be of that school. No, let's do it again. We can do it better. We can do it better. One more, we can do it better. Now I'm a huge fan of first takes.
And so what is it that you hear in that first take?
Adolescent mischief, surprise, the urgency of the first take, what's going to happen next? It's a first date.
It is a first date, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you're on your best behavior.
Right. Best behavior, true. And you want to impress, but you don't want to impress too much. It's just, there's only one first time.
It's true. And that is sort of a sign of maturity, actually, isn't it? I mean, because when you're young, you want to control everything.
Right.
As an artist, you want to control everything, every moment.
Jeremy Davenport.
Right. And then as you grow, you know what I mean, as an artist, then maybe you, again, like you understand the role that silence takes. You understand the role of surprise. You understand that less is more sometimes.
You know, I call it the regardless factor. I've listened to Ellis Marsalis play, and you can hear him play with 8-year-olds that cannot play, and he still sounds like Ellis. He is unaffected by the greatness or the inexperience of those around him. Everything about his approach to the instrument is like a hologram. A hologram is a laser-impregnated image. If you were to shatter that image, every shard still projects the whole image.
Oh.
So he is that way, and that's actually a basic philosophy of mine to music. In the studio, every track, even if it's the hi-hat track, should still express the song. The bass part, it should still be about the song. It's not how many notes you play. It's about what are you trying to express, and does that little part of it still reveal the whole picture?
What is the difference between a blue note and a grace note?
A grace note is, in classical music, it's a note that's preceded by its immediate neighbor, either upper or lower, and the preceding note is of much shorter duration and usually less softer than the antecedent note. Like, here's the note. The grace note would be, or in real time. And in New Orleans piano, that's used a lot. Professor Longhair made that part of the music. So the grace note is a note that it's an on-purpose flam of two adjacent notes.
Blue note, you can use a grace note as a blue note, like. But the technical blue note is that note which fights the harmony or tears against the harmony. Here's a G7 chord, and here's a blue note. So it can be a note on the blues scale, usually the third or the flat five or the seven, but because it tears against the harmony, it gets your attention right away.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Hallelujah Jackson knew the power of that.
A free music lesson from David Torkanowski. How often does that happen? We'll get even more out of him after the break. We're talking with David Torkanowski about the people, music, and ideas that have influenced his work as a piano player, composer, and bandleader. His most current project puts him on record, or on MP3, with some of New Orleans' finest. They call themselves Fleur Debris. That's Fleur as in fleur-de-lis, and Debris as in the roast beef po' boy. Let's start with a Fleur Debris variation on the Professor Longhair classic, Mardi Gras.
Tony DeGrotti and George Porter and Simon Lott, and we've recorded it actually in this room during a party. So you hear people come, glasses clinking. It was just such great playing, I had to release it. I mean, I figure we're having a party in my studio, why not record it? Now the sax player is Aaron Fletcher, who is from Thibodaux, Louisiana, but he's just back from Los Angeles, where he's played with Anita Baker and Tina Marie, the late Tina Marie. So he's got a lot of industry experience. So it's kind of humid Cannonball Adderley meets Gerald Albright, great player. And George Porter is the constant. And it's great because George Porter, you talk about fearless. I'll ask him to play a highly advanced jazz tune that he's never played before. And I'm not talking about anything that's even related to something he knows. But his ears are so big, he'll catch it the first time, and then he owns it. He's a consummate musician.
Well, obviously, you're a radio presenter. You've got your weekly Blues Ball that's on Thursdays, in which you feature blues music from Louisiana or the surrounding area.
Actually, I tend to break format a lot. I do Johnny Guitar Watts, and I do funk and soul, and you know,
just, it's true.
Yeah, I mean, I'll even play Tower of Power from time to time.
Yes, you play Tower of Power. Not just from time to time, you play it pretty often, Tower of Power.
I'm just getting back to Harry Shearer because he chides me for doing it.
But then you also break out Sun House.
You know what I mean?
John the Revelator. That's a great song.
It really is.
So, David Torkanowski, we are coming to the end of our time together, but I wanted to ask one last question.
Okay.
And that is, we want to know about a song that comes from your past, a song you have nothing to do with. You know, you're not receiving any royalties. You're not, promoting the performer, but a song you used to listen to when you were a kid, a young person that helped you become who you are today.
Wow, that's a tall order.
It doesn't have to be your favorite song,
right? I mean, it was probably Up in Errol's Room, which is an Errol Garner record that my mother bought me when I was a kid, and I wore it out. I really dug it for many reasons. It had a rhythmic thing to it. He had a conga player, Jose Mangual, and he also grunted when he played, which fascinated me.
Yeah,
He was singing, but you couldn't tell it was melodically related to what he was playing. He was just humming what he was playing. And some years later, when I started playing, I think this was my senior year in high school, I had a gig on Bourbon Street at a place called the Stage Door Canteen, which was an offshoot of a New York place. And they featured different musical acts. We were the house trio. And for a couple of weeks, we traded sets with the Errol Garner Quartet. And he taught me a lesson during the day, not every day, but almost every day. And the bass player came along to translate because Errol didn't really know music per se, but it was quite a special time.
Bouncy tune.
Yeah, it's cool.
Where do you get, what's that song on?
That was on a record called Up in Errol's Room. So.
Okay, so tell me more.
Well, when I got a chance to play alongside him and take from him during those 2 weeks that he was here, of course, Misty was his big hit, and he played it every night, and he was happy to do so. And a patron called out from the audience, please play Misty, and of course he did. And when he was coming off the bandstand, this person was so overjoyed that he got to hear Errol play Misty that he went up and just hugged him as tight as he could and picked him up. And I just can imagine that must have been like stabbing him in the side, because his bursitis, if you barely touch somebody with bursitis, it's painful. This guy bear hugged him and lifted him. Errol didn't say a word. I saw him, have him tear up because it must have been painful. But he didn't say a word. He said, thank you very much. Thank you very much. So I just thought, what an elegant guy.
That is elegant. That really is. And, well, let's hear some more of that.
Even though the rhythm section is swinging, he's playing funk over it. And
he really is. Yeah. I mean, it swings. And I can hear him humming, too, just like you said. Yeah. What's it like, the difference between working for a solo project and working with an ensemble? I get the impression you like the company of a lot of people around and the work of creating something where everybody is equal. Or am I wrong?
No, I think you're right about that. I think we all enjoy that. Unless it's a solo record, it's always a conversation. My father used to say there's two types of music, good and bad. I mean, either it's real or it's not. He used to love to conduct for Sarah Vaughan, Modern Jazz Quartet, as well as he used to love to do Wagner and Brahms. And again, it's all part of the same lineage of music. So to me, it's just another offshoot of this fertile cauldron that is New Orleans.
Actually, that sounds a bit cliche.
Yeah,
fertile cauldron that is New Orleans.
It's true, though.
Can you do better than that?
No, I think that's about as good as it gets.
All right, first take.
No, I mean, it's true. Everything here influences everything else. Mm-hmm. It is the musical gumbo. That's cliche, but it's true. This music was born here because this was the nexus of culture. This was the place where the confluence of African and European musics happened. That's what jazz is. So that's, in my own upbringing, I had a confluence of
of African rhythm and European melody and harmony in my own house. So maybe bringing that to the table is what people thought, oh man, white boy can play.
David Torkanowski, thank you.
Thank you, Gwen. It was fun.
David Torkanowski, jazz musician, band leader, and all-around wise guy, spoke to us in his studio in downtown New Orleans. His latest project features George Porter Jr. on bass, Tony DeGrotti, and or Aaron Fletcher on alto saxophone, and drummers Simon Lott and Zigaboo Modalist. Together, they are Fleur de Brie. We're listening to the band's take on the jazz classic, Monk's Dream. This is really good. So in the words of David Torkanowski, check it. Was Monk's Dream by Fleur de Brie. You're listening to Music Inside Out
from WWNO. Each week, we feature the people of Louisiana who've devoted their lives to making the music we call our own. Their experiences and influences are where our music comes from. If you'd like to tell us about a song that influenced you growing up, send an email to wwno.org and label it Music Inside Out. That's wwno.org. Don't forget to label the email Music Inside Out and tell us how to pronounce your name. Our show was produced by Lynette Johnson, Jason Ryan, and Bridget McCarthy. Our engineers are Jenny Lawson and Thomas Walsh. Our music theme was composed and performed by James Booker. Ron Biava is WWNO's development and marketing manager, and the general manager of WWNO is Paul Masson. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out. President's Day passed this week virtually unnoticed in New Orleans, where we're still getting over Mardi Gras. So, in honor of the Presidents of the United States and Abe Lincoln's doppelganger, Daniel Day-Lewis, who deserves an Academy Award this weekend, we're giving the last word to Oscar Brown Jr. 40 Acres and a Mule. Oh, Mr. Obama.
You know, I always enjoy playing Washington, D.C. Makes me feel not only among friends, but close to the seat of government. Provides me with an opportunity to deliver, for example, this open letter pressed into my hands by a man on my street. If I'm not mistaken, I once read, back during that short spell I spent in school, where every slave set free was supposed to get, for slaving, 40 acres and a mule. Now, you know, telling how much work was done by my ancestors under slavery's rule, but sure as hell the total got to run at least 40 acres and a mule. Now, I'm not saying this to see folks sweat, because I'm not bitter, neither am I cruel. But ain't nobody paid for slavery yet about my 40 acres and my mule. We had a promise that was taken back. When we hollered, it was hush, be cool. Well, me, I'm being rowdy, hot, and black. I want my 40 acres and my mule. Don't tell me not to get myself upset. Don't look at me like I'm some kind of ghoul. Just answer quietly, when do I get my gun? 40 acres and my mule. No thanks, I'll take my own self out to lunch. No thanks, I'll dig me my own swimming pool and lay and play around with my own bunch. Yeah. I get 40 acres and a mule. Cause interest gotta go on, just like rent. I may be crazy, but I ain't no fool. 100 years of debt at 10% per year, per 40 acres and per mule. Now, add that up. Ooh-wee, look at that. No wonder y'all call great-grandma Jewel. Just pay me that and call the whole thing square. Yes, Lordy, 40 acres and a mule.
Thank you very much. I'm only serious.